Blog Talk Radio.
Psychiatrist in private practice since 2003. Dr. Carroll previously was the director of inpatient services at the Bay Pine VA Hospital and the Bay Pine VA Medical Center. Dr. Carroll specializes in the treatment of children ages 6 and older and the treatment of adults, in other words, from the womb to the tomb. She's also an all-time triathlete. If you're having a problem getting through to the next level of athletics and you want to find out how to help get some help for it, Dr. Carroll's always available at her office on Bloomingdale Avenue, 336 East Bloomingdale Avenue, Brandon, Florida. And you can call her at area code 813-689-2466. We started the program with the rousing Miss Kate Smith because two things. One, we're getting very close to hockey season, but it's also the weekend where we dedicate a day to honor those who labor. And to some of the people that labor at a very, very, very low pay and are always away from their homes are those men and women in the United States Armed Forces. So we dedicate this program to them, and we have one special dedication. That's to Mrs. Sharon Carroll, Dr. Carroll's mother, and my spouse of 49 years. As of the 28th, we started our 50th year, so this program goes out to her. Guys, how you doing?
You know what? We're doing better than Sharon because she's been dealing with you for 50 years. So,
but congratulations.
Hashtag this one would be, what the hell was she thinking?
Wow, that's amazing, man. I mean, God, it just seems like 30 years ago when we were running around with
right.
you guys. Wow.
Right. Yep,
wow,
the Mighty Mighty
Bee. That is amazing.
Yep.
Congratulations again. That is truly a landmark.
Yeah. It's
absolutely
been good for both of us. Well, guys, we talked about tonight's card being very light. We only got one on Showtime, and that's J-Love, right? Jay Leon Love, right. Yeah. What do you think of that one, Z?
Well, Jay Leon Love, he's 18-0, and mm-hmm. I think he has maybe, 13 knockouts, 14 knockouts.
Mm-hmm.
Usually against, he's been getting steadily better competition, but he's been fighting kind of light, if you ask me. Mm-hmm. The last fight, he struggled a little bit and actually came up with my turnbuckle with the knuckle that happened to him. But he actually survived and put on a pretty good performance after that. But he's fighting a guy who is experienced. He has, I think he's 32 and maybe two losses.
Mm-hmm.
And he has like 26 knockouts.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and that should be interesting in and of itself because that kind of competition, we want to see Jay Leon Love fight.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah, the thing about Jay Leon Love, the reason why you see him so much on these showcase cards, be it on, Showtime or even on the undercard of a pay-per-view, is because he's been promoted by Mayweather Productions, the Mayweather Promotions. Mm-hmm. So being as though he's a Floyd-promoted fighter, he gets a lot of TV time that a lot of other fighters might not necessarily get. The drawback to that is when Jay Leon Love has, been asked to step up, though he is undefeated, he's never passed any test with flying colors. He's had a couple decisions that could have easily gone the other way. So the jury is really still out on Jay Leon Love.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see tonight. It's on Showtime. I think it's, is it 10 o'clock start? Get somewhere around there. Yeah.
But did you guys hear about the big news of the week, though, in regards to Jermaine Taylor?
Yeah. Yes, he got bailed out in time.
Yeah. Jermaine Taylor, who has a somewhat, by most accounts, undeserved shot at a super middleweight title against Sam Solomon, or a middleweight title, I should say, against Sam Solomon, on October 7th or 8th, I'm not sure. Forgive me for not knowing specifically that date. It's going to be televised by Fox Sports 1.
Yeah,
but,
October 8th.
But Sam Solomon, regardless, Jermaine Taylor got some type of altercation with his cousin at his house, and Jermaine Taylor shot his cousin multiple times. He admitted it to the police. He was taken in. He was put in jail. He's been bailed out. It was bonded at $25,000, and he doesn't go back to court till the day after the fight. So that is what is going on in Jermaine Taylor's life. That's been the big news of the week. It's been a big shock. There's, details are still sketchy, so there's a lot of speculation as to whether he felt his life was threatened or whether he just lost his temper. But this occurred at his house. His wife is the one who called 911. So this is a very serious situation for Jermaine Taylor. And, and his cousin right now is in serious condition, obviously, because it's not a murder charge right now. It's aggravated assault and battery.
Yeah, that's just some ease up by the guys who wrote that up, because normally that would be written up as an attempt at homicide. So they do give him some leeway there. But first-degree domestic battery, that's not good. If it was in the state of Florida, he wouldn't have gotten bail. He would have had to go before a circuit court judge who would then decide to set bail. I can guarantee it wouldn't be. It'd be more in the area of $150,000 to $1 million.
And you know what? It's funny you say that, Butch, because a lot of the speculation, first of all, a lot of the speculation comes from Jermaine Taylor's reputation. He's always had a sterling reputation. And not the kind of guy who would be involved in something of this nature. And then the fact that the bond was also, pretty low for this type of crime. It leads one to kind of surmise as to whether, you know, his cousin was there with a friend, whether they were not the aggressors per se, and maybe
right.
Jermaine was defending himself or felt his life was in danger. But to me, it's funny you said that. When I read that the bond was $25,000, it allowed me to believe, or led me to believe, I should say, that the judge in question must have obviously known more about the details than we did.
Right.
He felt that not only is Jermaine not a flight risk, but that it didn't warrant a higher bond. That's what kind of surprised me. So it led me to believe that maybe, you know, Jermaine, maybe there's a self-defense issue with what happened. Who knows?
Yeah. And the other thing is that he is allowing him to he was allowed to leave to go down to Florida to
train.
Yeah. That in itself says that this is not going to go anywhere.
Then the other thing too, and this obviously in a court of law, and this should be, is completely irrelevant to the case. But the fact of the matter is that the cousin in question, the cousin that was shot, the victim, has, from what I hear, a pretty long rap sheet. So, you know, again, the judge could have looked at certain circumstances and the circumstances involved in the shooting, and he could have deemed that, you know, that Jermaine Taylor is not a risk to society, is not a flight risk. And, that was a pretty low bond for, you know,
yep.
firing multiple times and shooting somebody multiple times. That's a pretty
right.
low bond. So it's funny. We were thinking the same thing, Butch.
Yep. Hey, Mr. Klitschko going to get back in the ring finally, huh?
Well, he tore his
November
bicep. 15th. Yeah, he tore his bicep. And you know what? The funny thing is, that's a fight that wasn't getting a lot of publicity, Klitschko against Pulev.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a real fight. It wasn't Klitschko against Marius Wack or Jean Mormick, you know what I mean? Pulev
right.
is an undefeated guy who doesn't have tremendous power. Again, he's a big guy. He's a guy who's like 6'5". So he's going to match Klitschko size-wise, and he's a good boxer. He was able to beat Tony Thompson, and he was the first guy not named Klitschko, you know, basically in the last 14 years to beat Tony. So, you know, this guy, he can box. He has a very good jab. He has good movement. And, you know, size-wise and stylistically, he presented more of a competitive fight for Klitschko. It was a fight I was looking forward to. I didn't know if it was going to be televised in the USA. But, of course, Klitschko tore his bicep. It's one you still favor Klitschko in, primarily because Pulev is not a big puncher at all. Again,
mm-hmm.
Klitschko is not a big taker. And Pulev is the kind of guy who can touch on Klitschko a little bit. He has some skill, and I think Tony would attest to that. Tony, also, I think what Tony was online with is he favored Klitschko, but he did say mm-hmm. Pulev has some skill, though.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah. And I figured you would have to go with a certain level of experience. I think Pulev, his best shot would probably be early to maybe dictate the fight. But if he can't really do it early and Klitschko starts finding his groove, it'll be problematic.
Good.
You know what else, too? I think one of the things that, for me, that I thought Tony presented Vladimir with in both fights, he presented him with a puzzle that was physically, similar to himself, but also physically unaccustomed to what he was used to. You know, Vladimir is used to fighting smaller guys. He has to keep back. Tony was able to touch him. And, Tony, to me, kind of necessitated his knockout in that second fight because he made Klitschko have to kind of fight outside of his style. Klitschko had to become more aggressive against Tony because Tony, to me, those first few rounds was holding his own, if not outboxing Klitschko to a certain point. He was having problems with Tony's dimensions, and I think Pulev's dimensions could give Klitschko some problems. Pulev's a young guy, too. He's not 40 years old. So I think it's an interesting fight. You got to favor Klitschko. You have
mm-hmm.
to favor Klitschko, but Pulev has some dimensions that could really, make it a competitive affair. And the fact of the matter is, the sad fact of the matter is, because of the Povetkin fight, which, believe it or not, drew a lot of viewers, but was a god-awful fight with Klitschko and Povetkin. It was a god-awful fight to watch, even though it drew a lot of viewers. But, you know, United States broadcasting networks aren't so quick to invest in a Klitschko fight, and this is the fight that many of us should invest in, and no one had picked it up as of yet.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah. I guess Eddie Snyder's had too much time on his hands buying up all the other cable TV, so he can't talk to guys at at either one of the agencies to get it. What do you think on that one, Z? Do you think Klitschko is going to, with that long reach of his? I mean, he could be standing in the middle of the middle. He's got what, 86 inch? Is that what it is?
I don't know, but always with that reach, Klitschko, he has a habit of holding it out a lot, using it as a marker.
Right.
And one thing, one of the old timers, what the old timers would do a lot, they would hit your elbow.
Mm-hmm.
They would bang that arm out the way, or else, you know, head movement around it.
Right.
You know, you're not going to, you know, so, I mean, if it's there, hit it. He's going to stop holding it out. That elbow joint's going to start hurting. He'll stop holding it out.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, as I say, once Klitschko, you have to get him early out of rhythm.
Sure.
You know, not necessarily knock him out, but make him, because Klitschko, he's as good as he is, he's not a contact guy. He's not going to sit there and go contact for contact with you. And we saw that
he's a one-way traffic
fight.
Guy. He's a one-way traffic guy.
Exactly. We saw that in the Povetkin fight. That's what made it so goodness awful boring, because he was allowed to hold Povetkin every time. He stopped punching and just lunged to hold him a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
And he was allowed to do that all fight long, to where, you know, maybe a bigger guy, he's not going to be able to do that with. A guy who could kind of match him size-wise, strength-wise, to where he's going to have to use his feet more. Or, as Ty said, he may have to get more aggressive as he did with Tony. Because what happened, when he found his groove with Tony, because Tony had to make him find his groove, you're right. But when
right.
he did, he got more aggressive. He stepped it up against Tony. To where, I mean, you have to get him early kind of frantic. You get him a little frantically panicky, then, you know, you have more control in the fight, more control than he does. Because with the Klitschko, both Klitschko's well, now with one Klitschko, it's all about control, all about, you know, ring generalship. He's either going to have his distance or he's going to hold you.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think? I know Ty's going to be happy that he's going to, October 18th, his man is going to be fighting. The Filipino Flash. Notito Denair.
I'm actually not a Nonito fan.
I
respect him as a fighter, but I'm not a Nonito Donaire fan.
I must be Chris was.
Yeah, not at all. He actually, I'm, you know, I may be in the majority, but I've always felt Nonito was a little overrated. I don't think he was exposed against Guillermo Rigondeaux, but I think what happened was he met a prime guy who could box, and Nonito never was really a good boxer. Not from a fundamental standpoint. And you know what? It's funny because he's fighting Nick Walters.
Right.
And, Zito, you remember Nick Walters. He's the Jamaican kid who just blasted out Garcinia. You know, Nick is going to – I mean, Nonito's faced some punchers. But at 126, Nick Walters is a young guy, and he's a young big guy for that weight. And he is probably going to be the biggest puncher that Donaire has faced. You know, as far as a prime fighter, he's faced guys with more knockouts, but, I mean, not a guy this big in his prime who can punch the way Nicholas Walters can punch. Where you got to give Donaire a slight edge is definitely experience. Donaire's a more experienced fighter. Nicholas Walters is, you know, he's been in with Darchinian, but he really has not faced the level of competition that Donaire is or the level of competition that Donaire has faced. So it could be a very interesting fight. It could be a 50-50 fight in some ways, primarily because Donaire is experienced and Donaire punches hard. We know Donaire has a solid chin and he's still not, you know, to me, he's not as the flash at 126 like he was a few years back at 118, 122 or whatever. But he's still fast, and he still, you know, again, delivers a really solid punch. I think we'll learn a little bit about Nick Walters. If Nick Walters can take a good punch, because Donaire is capable of landing one, if he can take a good punch, we got a fight on our hands, because we're going to see what kind of punches Donaire could take, because Nick Walters is, I mean, he's a beast, man. It's just a matter of, is he ready for this step up? But, I mean, the kid is a beast.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you this much. This is a dangerous fight for Donaire. And I'm going to tell you, he hasn't looked the same after that Rigondeaux loss.
Nope.
He when he fought Darchinian afterwards, Darchinian was basically in the fight. He had Donaire kind of thinking in
on his feet. Was winning the fight.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he basically. And then when he fought his last fight, I think it was the guy, Zvekar.
Oh, when he fought Simski Zvekar.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the fight that where he was gifted a technical decision based on a cut. But that was a fight where he didn't look well at all. I thought, in fact, it looked to me. You know what? He actually won that bout. He won that bout on the basis of a knockdown. Because, you know, yeah. A lot of times the first round, he kind of got a feel-out process. And he knocks Simki down. But outside of that, Simki was kind of outboxing. And what we're starting to see now with Nonito, ever since the Guillermo Rigondeaux fight, is a propensity to get outboxed. I don't know if he's going to have to worry about that with Nicholas Walters. And Nicholas Walters stylistically may play a little bit more into Donaire's strengths. With Victor Arcinia made it tough because Victor Arcinia didn't attack reckless like he did the first fight. Nick Walters is a young, strong, very confident kid. He's the kind of kid who's going to come at you. And that does play into Nonito Donaire's strength. So it could, again, that's the biggest thing. Donaire has not looked good against someone who's actually tried to establish a boxing game plan against him at all since Rigondeaux. So, I mean,
Since Rigondeaux, he hasn't looked good to me at all. I mean, he's won, but he's won based off of that power against basically both fighters.
No, he had the two fights, Darchinian and Simski, and he didn't look good in either one of those fights at all.
And right here, he's facing a guy who's going to test him more than those two guys at this point in time. Unless Donaire's going to go ahead and get him out of there, you know, wipe him out in a round or two, if he's not going to do that, he's going to get tested more than those two guys tested.
Well, he's probably going to be hurt, too. You mean, you look at Walter's record, 24-0 with 20 knockouts.
And I think what it comes down to is I don't trust Nonito Donaire to be able to necessarily outbox this kid without hurting him. So if Nonito cannot hurt this kid, then I don't think he can keep Nick Walters off of him.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I think Nick Walters is just too big, too strong, too aggressive, and hits too hard. With that being said, Nick Walters has never faced a fighter the caliber of Darchinian. So there are a lot of variables going into this fight. And you know what the funny thing is you would think there are more question marks surrounding Nick Walters because he's more of the unknown commodity. But like Zito said, ever since the two fights after that Rigondeaux meltdown, you know, there are just as many questions about Donaire right now, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because we know basically what Nick Walters is going to do. And the question with him is, I mean, he's going to get touched. Can he withstand that? Can he withstand that, especially early? And if he can, then I think it's going to be trouble for Donaire. I've seen it in his fight game. I see just the look in his eyes when he was fighting Darchinian, he was a little panicky.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he just... Right now, I just think he's kind of mentally getting himself together. And fighting the Nick Walters might not be the best thing for him at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what, Zito? Nick Walters is not the kid that you don't want to have your confidence against. You don't want to be unsure when you're fighting that kid. And what it really comes down to is there's one real question surrounding Nick Walters. How good is he? I mean, we know he's good. We know he's solid. We know he's, you know, a certain level. But how good is he? And this Darchinian fight or this Donaire fight will tell us a lot. And then with Donaire is, how good is he still? Or how good was he really? And, again, this fight is going to tell us a lot because right now 126 is a deep division. You know, we're talking about these two. Also, Evgeny Gravanovich, who destroyed Billy Gibbs twice, and, of course, the guy who I think is the best fighter at 126 right now, that's Lomachenko. So, I mean, it's a pretty deep division. We also got Maris, Johnny Gonzalez. So 126 is one of the deepest divisions of boxing, featherweight. So we're having a featherweight renaissance.
Right now, and it's good to see a Donaire Walters fight.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what the funny thing is he initially stated that he would give – it's one of those names, Simki Vetkaya, he said he would give him the immediate rematch because a lot of, you know, that fight ended the controversy. A lot of people didn't think he was winning anyway. And so initially he was getting some slack for foregoing the rematch, but he's taking on potentially a much more dangerous assignment, at least a comparably dangerous assignment. I don't think this kid, Nick Walters, is to the point with the experience where he could box like Simki, but this kid can punch, and he's young, and he's hungry. He's at this point, he's kind of like a raw, a little bit more raw, a little less developed, featherweight Keith Thurman. Seriously. That's what the kid, is looking like right now. And again, same thing with Keith. If all of a sudden you say, all right, Keith Thurman, you're going to fight Manny Pacquiao. It's like, all right, Keith, we know you're good, but the question is, how good are you? Well, that's what we're going to find out about Nick Walters. How good are you?
What do you think about the – we got Adrian Broner getting back into the ring on the 8th next Saturday night on live on Showtime. He's going against Emmanuel Taylor.
I think right now it could be a good fight for Broner. Not saying Taylor's going to be a pushover because he's a pretty good fighter.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think right now it could be a good fight for Broner. He's not going to get the same stylistic matchup as he did against Madonna. So he's not going to get worn out like that. Mm-hmm. And that's always a plus for him right now. And I think Walters is the kind of guy that he could be able to find. Broner, he's not a foot mover. Taylor is a guy that he'll be able to find. I mean, Taylor, he's a pretty good boxer. And Broner, he's not the best of foot mover. But he does have quick enough feet in certain explosions.
Well, here's the thing. Taylor's only 23 years old. He's 18-2, like 12 knockouts. He's only 23 years old. He's a young guy. So he's a guy, it's very rare that Adrian Broner at 25 steps in the ring as the younger guy. But he's got a younger man in front of him. A younger guy who's hungry, who was at one time considered, a pretty, well-touted prospect. Here's the thing with Adrian Broner. When Adrian Broner was fighting at 130, 135, I mean, he was so much bigger than those guys. And then, he had that extra caveat of being quicker than those guys. And he was really like a little Mack truck. And he just ran over, outside of Ponce de Leon, he ran over the competition at that weight class. Well, ever since Broner's moved up past that 140-pound class, he hasn't really been able to put a significant dent in guys with his power. Although Emmanuel Taylor is not like a Marcos Madonna, either was Carlos Molina, who Amir Khan won a pretty easy decision from, although he got touched on a lot with the right hand because that's what Amir Khan does, but he still won a very wide decision. The fight between Adrian Broner and Carlos Molina was a lot more debatable as far as the decision. I thought Adrian Broner did enough to win, but he didn't look impressive at all. And you concur with me, it looks like Adrian Broner. One of two things has to happen for him to have success at the elite level at 140, because the fact of the matter is he's not stinking guys with one punch. Either A, he's really going to have to learn how to move his feet, like Zito said. He's got to move the feet more. Or B, he's got to throw significantly more punches. Because a guy like Carlos Molina, who was nowhere near his talent level, couldn't hurt him, was able to hang around just by being busy. A guy like Paulie Malignaggi, who's a world champion, but really, who's a little bit past it, nowhere near his talent level, couldn't hurt Broner. But you know what? I thought he won that fight just by being busy. So even though you have to favor Adrian Broner against Emmanuel Taylor, the blueprint is out there. You fight Adrian Broner, let your hands go. If you're capable enough of withstanding his power, let your hands go, and you can win a decision on him because he does not let his hands go, and he does not move away from punches, and his defense is nowhere near as formidable as he thinks.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I think is, though, at 140, I think he's more comfortable than he was at 147, obviously. But at 140, I think that's more or less where he belongs. He's too big for the 135, 130 division.
I think he's definitely more comfortable. I think, the guys aren't as big and as strong. But, again, at 140, he hasn't shown to have that type of power he had when he was, you know, accruing all those knockouts. Not these again, these guys at 140, a lot of these guys were, you know, they're weighing in fighting at 150 as well, 152, 154. And Adrian hasn't been able to put these kind of guys away. He wasn't able to, again, Khan couldn't put Carlos Molina away, but Adrian wasn't able to dent him either. Adrian has no knockouts above 135. Doesn't mean he's not capable of it, but at the same point, based on how he was fighting at 135 and how he's been fighting ever since, he fights like a truck who tries to slowly, like Vito said, kind of slowly stalk his opponent and beat him up with power shots. But when the power shots aren't working, he's not letting his hands go enough to win rounds. And then the other issue is defensively, he stands there and tries to do the shoulder roll. He allows too much coming in, and he doesn't back away and slip away from punches. One thing about Amir Khan is Zito and I talk about this all the time. I'm not a huge Amir Khan fan, but one thing I recognize about Amir Khan, I like him, and one thing I do recognize about him is even if he's not the best fighter, he is one of the best round winners in the sport because he's fast, he lets his hands go, and he fights at distance. And that's why I think he is a handful for anyone because even though his chin is beautiful, the fact of the matter is until you catch this guy's chin, you're not going to win rounds from him. Well, you know, it's kind of the opposite with you know, Adrian Broner. For all his talent, he's a guy who can lose rounds very easily.
Well, the thing with Broner, too, is he's an inside fighter. Broner, I mean, to be totally honest, he's an effective inside fighter. From distance, unless Broner's pot shotting at you, I mean, successfully, then he's not really a distance guy. He doesn't establish the jab like that, to be honest, and I think that Floyd mentality, I think he has a little bit of that Floyd mentality a little too much as far as his own fight game, because I think he would benefit from being more aggressive. I think he'd be benefit from bobbing his head, weaving his head, getting a little more Joe Frazier-ish, just to be honest, because he's, as he's trying to do the Floyd defense, he doesn't know how to slip the punches. He's not accustomed to that. He's accustomed to taking the punches and then flashing his punches. That's what he's in the give and take. He's not a guy who's going to counterpunch you. He doesn't have the angles.
What he typically is, like you see on the inside, he's a pretty good inside fighter, but what he typically is more accurate than you. And so you'll throw five punches, and he'll slip, you know, three of them. Two of them will get in, but then he's going to come back and rip you with four clean, hard shots. And you know what? That was dropping lightweights. But now all of a sudden when he comes back and rips those three or four shots, the guy in front of him is ripping five more. And, you know, again, he doesn't use his feet to escape danger. He doesn't slip. So he's there for the incoming fire. He relies on a defense that he hasn't truly perfected to blunt everything. And it's just not working. And, he's a guy who loses rounds. He shouldn't. He can lose rounds and fight. He totally was dictating that fight to Carlos Molina, but at the same time, he was giving up rounds just by not being busy enough and allowing too much incoming fire without a return fire and response.
Yeah, he's not bad with as far as rolling his shoulders and stuff.
Not at all.
He's bad with his feet. It's all about creating the angles. He's not rolling his shoulders, then moving his feet to the proper, to the side, to the proper angles. As I say, the aggression probably at this point will help him more than anything. Just don't be stiff. Don't keep yourself up. Bend at the waist. You know, roll your shoulders, roll your head around.
You know what LeBron would help?
Bend your knees, for goodness sake.
You know what Adrian Broner's fighting style reminds me of, Zito? You remember in the mid to late 90s, the And-One basketball mixtapes came out, the And-One. Everybody was in this And-One league. Remember that?
Yeah.
And it was like the hot dog playground showboat stuff.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you started watching our NBA players and nobody could hit an outside shot anymore. You know what I mean? Nobody could shoot from deep because everyone was kind of infatuated with the quick Sports Center highlights. And it's almost like Adrian Broner just watched highlights of Floyd Mayweather and didn't take any of the fundamentals with him. You know what I mean? Because what he's doing is a caricature of Floyd.
Yeah.
And I mean, even to the point of how he markets himself. But in his fighting style, he's a caricature of Floyd without employing the subtle elements that Floyd does to make him successful.
And that's the whole thing. It's all talent and little skill. I'm not saying he's not skilled, but for what he's trying to do, he needs a lot more skill.
You know what? It's funny you say that because, again, we had this conversation with Carl Froch. Carl Froch fundamentally can be crude, but he's a very skilled fighter. Adrian Broner has great fundamentals, but he's not a skilled technician in the ring. And a lot of it is how you think, how you choose to fight. He doesn't fight a skilled fight. Even though he shows flashes of brilliant skill, he doesn't overall fight a skilled fight. You're absolutely right, Gita.
So what do you think?
I was going to say, that's why when it's like that, he doesn't throw many punches. He has to find his feet in a proper position to throw the punches he wants to throw. And in fighting, in boxing, you're not going to get that all the time. You're not going to get what you want. You have to, you know, do other things. Move the feet to the proper angles. You can't depend on your opponent putting himself there.
Right. You know, it's funny. I had a boxing client ask me if you know, Floyd was really the best ever because, you know, that's what Floyd claims. Hmm. And, you know, I said to him, I said, you know, to be the best ever to me, you have to be an A+. You got to be A+ defense, A+ offense. You know, and you know, not even talking about intangibles. I said, but when I look at Floyd Mayweather, I said, he's an A+ defense. I said, but he's like a B+ offense, maybe a B offense. I said, offensively, I said, I don't think he's a great offensive fighter. I think he's a good offensive fighter. I would even hesitate to say very good because his offense comes off of your defense. And that's one thing Adrian Broner has learned. Something Floyd doesn't do a lot is Floyd is not one to, not especially not in the last, you know, 10 years or so. You know, a little bit when he was younger, not so much anymore. But Floyd doesn't open you up. Floyd doesn't open you up. Floyd waits for you to open up, and then he takes advantage of the openings. But he's not the kind of boxer who creates openings. And Adrian Broner is not the kind of boxer, you know, subsequently who creates openings. But at the same time, he's nowhere near as skilled as Floyd at taking advantage of the openings when they do present themselves. So he really needs to learn. Instead of being, you know, being a mini Floyd Mayweather, he needs to be the best Adrian Broner he can be.
Absolutely.
And that still would be a hell of a fighter.
Mm-hmm. What do you think? I'm waiting. I saw this one, and I couldn't wait to hear your report on this one. Carl Froch talking about the possibility of a fight with DeGaulle.
Well, the reason why we're hearing about that is because apparently that means that the Carl Froch, Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. Negotiations are dead in the water. That was a big negotiation going on for the MGM Grand. That does appear to be dead. Also, not to talk about Chavez, since we're talking about Foch, but also Chavez's team recently turned down a fight against Anthony Durrell for his title. So Chavez is kind of slowly fading away into obscurity. I've seen a joke where somebody called him Julio Cesar Ward. I thought, Zita, I meant to tell you that, Zita. I thought you'd find that funny, given your piece you wrote on Ward for Doghouse Boxing. As far as Carl Froch and DeGaulle, DeGaulle has one loss. It was a close, debatable decision to George Groves. DeGaulle is a good fighter. The thing that kind of is interesting about that fight is just recently I read where Carl Froch said, me and DeGaulle would be big, you know, because he's looking at it would be a big domestic clash.
Yeah,
but just a few months ago, right before he started negotiations with Chavez, you know, when he beat George Groves, it was, you know, immediately announced that DeGaulle is mandatory. The first thing he said is, you know, I don't know if I – he said, if I don't get a big fight, I may retire. If Chavez doesn't work out, I may retire. And the reason why, he said, is because I don't know if I can get up for James DeGaulle. And so I found it kind of strange that, you know, within a few months, now that the Chavez thing has kind of fallen in the toilet, now he's saying, oh, it would be huge. Now, it would be huge, but at the same time, just because it's huge doesn't mean you can get up for this opponent. So we saw what happened when he couldn't get up for George Groves the first time. He, you know, he admitted that. So it would be interesting. That's not the fight he wants. It would be a, you know, a somewhat big fight in the UK, not as big as he and Groves. He can't top that, which is why he was looking to do something big in Las Vegas, because he hasn't had that. So this is by no means is this the fight he wants. This is what he would accept. Domestically, it would be a big moneymaker for him, but he's really, you know, for his legacy, he wants that big fight in Las Vegas. This is not even a consolation prize for him at this point.
Yeah.
Carl Froch, he's going to I think he has no problem getting up for the guy. Once it's time for him to get in the training, get into the mold, he'll have no problem. He even in the first George Groves fight, he got rocked, he got dropped. But eventually he won. Maybe they you know, can say early stoppage and everything, but you know, I think he won that fight and two may have proved that more dramatically.
But the one thing he did admit after the fight was that, you know, one thing he admitted after the fight and all the lead up, he said, "I'm not making excuses." He goes, "But, you know, going into the fight, who was George Groves?" He goes, I just came off of fighting this person, that person, that person." He goes, "I couldn't get up for George Groves." He goes, "I could get up now." So when he said that about James Miguel, you know, it kind of led me to believe that that's what he honestly feels. At 36 years old, and he doesn't talk about the fight when he talks about getting up. He talks about putting himself through the rigors of the training he does. And, you know, he's like, James de Gaulle, initially he didn't feel James de Gaulle was worth it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny because he had said at one point, any contest between me and him, of course it must go into third grade English, would be huge. It would be like a domestic fight between a legend of the sport and an Olympic champion. Holy cat. I don't know what the balloons he was taking air out of, but that seems to be pretty high in the clouds, don't you think?
Well, he's a good promoter, too. He's a good salesman.
Yeah.
And he'll sell any event he's in.
Sure.
But again, by no means is this – it's not a fight he was looking for, boy. It's just he was looking for, you know, something bigger. At 36 years old, he's looking to do – again, he said Wembley – he'll never be able to top what happened in Wembley Stadium. I agree with that. You know, 80,000 people was packed. It was an awesome atmosphere. I watched the fight.
Mm-hmm.
But so what he was looking to do is at 36, I'm looking for things that solidify his legacy. And he just doesn't feel that a de Gaulle fight, you know, solidifies his legacy. So, again, it's not the fight he's looking for. It's the fight he'll take because outside of a Chavez in Vegas, it probably is the biggest money maker, you know, available for him. There was some talk of him fighting the German light heavyweight Brahmer, but that, even though that could be a big fight in Germany, you know, he makes much more money staying at 168 and fighting de Gaulle in the UK. So this is just the, you know, the best option that's available since that big money Las Vegas fight that he really wants is, you know, not coming to fruition.
Great. And Marco Houck's going tonight, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I believe that's tonight.
Yeah, I just checked something here on the line. Yeah, he is going tonight. For our listeners, we had scheduled Philadelphia area promoter David Feldman, who's the son of Marty, famed boxer and promoter himself, Marty Feldman. But Marty's in the hospital, and we want to send out our deepest respects to him. He's in serious condition in the hospital at used to be Tri-County. It's the Springfield Hospital in Springfield, Pennsylvania. So David can't be on with us tonight, but he will be on with us in the near future. I did talk to Danny Batchelder. He has signed Danny to a fight in 2 weeks up in the casino up in Bethlehem. And if you guys are going to be available, he's offered to, now this is going to be the bare knuckle fight.
Oh, wow. I would love to go to that. Wouldn't you, Zito?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Oh, my God. Yeah, if you could get a ticket to that.
Yeah,
And you know what? You know what, Butch? As a producer, you've gotten a ticket to main event shows at the Leah Cora Center. So you know what, Butch? I'm of the belief that a bare-knuckle boxing fight should be no problem for you.
It won't be. No, Dave's already said that. We'll get that lined up. And also...
Where is that at again, Butch? I'm sorry.
It's up in Bethlehem, the Sands Casino in Bethlehem.
Oh, at the Bethlehem Casino, yeah.
Yeah, you just take 309, or you can take the turnpike up or take 309 up.
Yeah, my wife and I were going to go stay a weekend there once. That was one of the places we considered.
All right. Well, do you want me to see if I get her a pass, too?
Of course you would appreciate a pass. You would take pictures. She's a great photo.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I'll take care of that. And then I'll text Danny and tell you guys are going to be there and see if he can't get out to talk to you for a few minutes.
Absolutely.
Oh, speaking of local boxers and speaking of local boxers and promoters, man, what happened to Russell Peltz's guy, Mike Jones?
He got annihilated.
Wow. That was a shock.
Yeah.
That was a shock.
It's a shock to Russell, too.
I'm sure. I mean, you know, Mike Jones, he has a win over Jesus Soto Palas. And
right.
Actually, two wins, one by my estimation, but two according to his record. And, you know, the funny thing is, you know, and I meant to tell you this, but then he lost. But I was reading in an interview with Mike Jones right before his fight with Herrera, with Jamie Herrera, that he acknowledged that he fought the wrong fight against Randall Bailey. He said, I was fighting to avoid his right hand the whole fight. I was too worried about what he was capable of doing and not, you know, thinking about what I am capable of doing. And the funny thing is, you know, we watched the fight, and that's exactly what we said. He's trying not to get in the right hand.
In round one.
He fought the whole, and he acknowledged that. And so, you know what, it's very rare that you see a fighter so honestly assess his loss, especially when his loss comes down to him being fearful of being hit by a punch. So
right.
I was really wishing him well, and, you know, he went out there and he dropped the guy hard in the second round, dropped him in the third round, and then, and, you know, the guy weathered the storm, and then from that point on, Mike Jones was eating shots. And, you know, I don't know, I mean, I never thought, I don't know if you guys remember this, they were at one time talking about Mike Jones, you know, he gets a win, he fights a Pacquiao. And I never thought Mike Jones was on that level, but I didn't see the precipitous drop in Mike Jones. I didn't see that coming. I didn't see this coming.
I right now equate Mike Jones with Jamil McClain, essentially.
Mm. Big time.
And if you remember, Jamil McClain, he had all the skills. He is a big guy. He can hit pretty hard.
Jamil McClain, real quick, too, guys. Jamil McClain is running for office in whatever state he's in, either for Congress or for – just to let you know. Jamil McClain, former prisoner, is now running for office. So go, Jamil.
Yeah.
Good.
That didn't work out for him. He was running the 20th district.
He's running
for Congress.
He's running for Congress?
Yeah, in the 20th district, which gave us another congressman who was the most investigated. He had been a judge, and then he was a federal judge, and he was taking bribes, and allegedly. But he had to be the smartest guy ever going, because the feds went into his office, gave him an envelope with $25,000 in marked bills, and the agent left the office. 2 minutes later, they went back into the office, and they ripped that place apart and couldn't find anything. So, he's been the most investigated congressman in the United States. But, Mike got 6.6% of the vote and lost. He was third in a three-man race.
He got 6.6%?
Yep.
Jamil McClain?
Jamil McClain, yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow. Wow.
So that's not saying much for the people over in the UK.
No, I mean 6.6% of the vote is 2,000 people now. You know what I mean? But Jamil McClain would do a good job.
Well,
you were saying that Jamil reminded you of Mike Jones, in a sense, or Mike Jones reminds you of Jamil?
Yeah, just in the sense that, you know, these guys, they were very good as far as fundamentally. But it was just seemed something in their ticker. Something didn't click in their heads and put a complete boxing game together. You know, maybe when the odds got tough, I'm not saying they fold, but it just seemed like they got disinterested at the wrong time. Or the fight,
you know,
the guy who they're fighting
the exact
against
word
made them
disinterested.
Yeah,
it's funny because Jamil to me always seemed disinterested. You know what I mean? He seemed like he boxed because he was pretty good at it, could make money, but he did seem disinterested. I think he kind of boxed his way out of prison, and that was it for him. But he did seem very disinterested. So it doesn't surprise me that he's running for Congress, because he seemed like the type of person who was always interested in things that were going outside the ring. Very articulate, well-spoken guy. Mike Jones to me, he was a, you know, he's big for a welterweight. And he was Russell did a great job promoting Mike Jones. You know, I don't know if Mike Jones was the fighter that Russell thought he was. I think that, you know, that's probably the most I could say on that. Mike Jones is talented, but I don't just being talented on a certain level is not enough. And I don't believe that Mike Jones was necessarily the fighter that he needed to be for his skill set. He wasn't the fastest. He was strong. Didn't hit. You know, he wasn't Tommy Hearns a puncher. So I don't know if he was the fighter, you know, capable enough to overcome the flaws that he had. You know, and most most fighters with flaws aren't, you know, capable of overcoming some of the flaws they have. So,
and physically and to his skill set, Mike Jones could control a fight. He was he had the ability. He has the ability to control fights. But I mean, it's just a little something might not go his way, and he seems to, you know, the why it just starts to unravel for him.
Yeah.
Guys, we're just about the end of our hour. The last thing I had on my list was Freddie Roach says he thinks the fight's going, the big fight's coming on. What do you think? That says
we've heard it so many times before. I believe it when I see the contract on actual TV.
Right.
The actual contract. I mean, they can say fight night's tomorrow, and I won't believe it till I see the contract on TV.
Sure.
You know, it's funny. Bob Arum was really talking about it a lot this week. He's talked, he's chatted it up. And, you know, Bob Arum is a smart businessman, and I think part of it is something Floyd Mayweather said a while ago and something Floyd Mayweather is guilty of. He said whenever, you know, they want to make money, a lot of times they'll mention Floyd Mayweather's name. Floyd, same thing with Pacquiao. He mentions Pacquiao's name a lot too. But I do think, you know, he's looking at a very low buy rate, you know, in comparison to Pacquiao's other buy rates with the Algeria fight. He's looking at a fighter that no one expects to give Pacquiao a good fight. A lot of people think it could be a competitive fight because Algeria is a very fit, smart boxer. He's long with a good jab. And, you know, so they think it could be a competitive fight score-wise. But they don't expect it to be a compelling and dramatic fight at all. So Bob Arum and team over at Top Rank, Todd DeBuff and those guys, they are looking realistically at a lower buy rate, specifically since the rematch with Bradley didn't do too well. So a part of me thinks that, you know what, he could be just trying to drum up, you know, some interest in Pacquiao by having people think, you know what, this is the last hurdle before Mayweather. There was some talk, though, that Mayweather might have a big announcement about a 2015 fight. So there has been some rumblings around the industry that that is something that could happen possibly in May of 2015. My first thought when I read that was, who cares? Who cares? That fight is so 3 years ago. It really is. I'll watch it when it comes, but as far as getting excited about it, I really don't care. It's not a fight I'm as interested in seeing right now. It's just, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
You know? They've actually allowed that fight to marinate past the point of consumer demand. You know, we'll all buy it, but the consumer demand is not for it anymore. No one really cares.
Yeah.
And actually right now, what you're hearing of is more people are interested in seeing the Keith Thurmans and, you know, the Kell Brooks and Sean Porter, they're interested in seeing this next new crop of welterweights sorted out. They, you know, I'm starting to read a lot of stuff about, all right, you know, once Mayweather and Pacquiao are gone, we can have, you know, this division sorted out. So, again, it's a fight that, you know, a fight fan is always going to want to tune in. There still are two biggest casual boxing names, so obviously it'll be a huge fight. But as far as the sport right now, and I remember one time they were saying, oh, it's so necessary for the sport. But as far as the sport, the timing has really passed it by. The sport doesn't need it. And at this point in time, neither do I.
Yeah.
Learn to do without it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, see, you want to lead us out?
I sure do. It's good to be back, and I want to thank you guys. These shows are definitely in memory of Bob. And if anyone wants to hear any fighting words, please do call. Top.
Hey, it was great being on with everyone this week. I wish everyone a blessed and peaceful weekend. Enjoy Monday's day off, it's Labor Day. Look forward to the fights tonight on Showtime, the fights next week as well. Bob is our co-pilot.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to thank you all for listening. And being here with faithful listeners. We just got our ratings in, and we went up again. We're now at 201,000 weekly listeners, so we can't say enough how much we appreciate that. These programs are brought to you each and every night of the week in grateful appreciation of the men and women of the United States Armed Forces, the men and women of Police and Fire Services. When you're out there and you see somebody in uniform, a simple thank you really goes a long way. That puts a smile on somebody's face. We also dedicate these programs to those who've lost their lives in the line of duty. Deputy Robert Anthony Carroll, Patrolman David Curtis, Patrolman Jeffrey Colquette, Sergeant Thomas Batinger, Patrolman Jeffrey Yazowitz, Patrolman David Crawford, Detective Randy Bell, Detective Ricky Childers, San Diego Officer Mike Hendler, Lieutenant Mike Zerba, Newcastle County Police Department, Patrolman Arnolfo Crispin, Lakeland PD, Deputy Barbara Pell, Broward County Sheriff's Office, Chief Al Hogle, Longbow Key Police Department, Chief Jimmy Ford, Wilmington Fire Department, Highway Patrolman Alonzo Moses, Philadelphia Highway Patrol, Highway Patrolman Brian Lazaro, Philadelphia Highway Patrol, Highway Patrolman Brian Murphy, Plymouth Township PA Highway Patrol, Lieutenant Bob Neary, Philadelphia Fire Department, Deputy Chief Mike Godwin, Philadelphia Fire Department, MIT Officer Sean Collier, Sergeant Mike Wilson, Charlotte County Sheriff's Office, Deputy Jonathan Pine, Orange County Sheriff's Office, Officer Robert Germain, Windermere, Florida Police Department, Florida Highway Patrol Trooper Chelsea Richards. My brothers and sisters, although you may be 10-7 at this point in time, at some time we'll be 10-10 at the table of the Lord. Until that time, may the roads rise up to meet you. May the winds be always at your back. May the rains fall softly on your fields and the sun shine on your face. Until we meet again, may the good Lord keep you and your families always in the hollow of his hands. Good night.
Shem alekma yelama, Shem ahezah yelama, Son ashen evorat fed, Hakuig again ma yelama.
Yeah.
Dispatch to 1999. County Dispatch to 1999. All units be advised, 1999 is responded to his last emergency. End of tour, 6/13/11.
Hey, Bob, we miss you. We love you.